Welcome to the Ecclesiastical History Society podcast. The EHS exists to explore all aspects and all periods of the history of Christianity. And in our podcasts, we welcome guests to discuss a wide range of topics. If you want to know more about the EHS, then visit our website, ecclesiasticalhistorysociety.com, or our social media pages.
Thank you for joining us in this EHS podcast episode. I'm your host, Angela Platt. I'm currently completing my PhD at Royal Holloway, University of London, which looks at the religious and familial experience of love in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Stuart McCain from St. Mary's University, Twickenham. Stuart is a lecturer in history and the course lead in liberal arts. He holds a doctorate in philosophy and history from the University of Oxford. He's the reviews editor for French history with the OUP and sits on the steering committee of History UK. His monograph, The Language Question Under Napoleon, formed from his doctoral work and published in 2018, offers a new interpretation of the nature of Napoleonic imperialism by exploring the linguistic dimensions of state power and the responses of local elites and administrators to Napoleonic language policy in the school, church, army, and law courts. He has also published articles on modern French history, including the one that we are discussing today, which is titled Our Ancestors Were Not Celts: History, Folklore, and the Celtic Past in Napoleonic France. So I'm delighted to be here with Dr. Stuart McCain to discuss your recent article. Thank you for joining us, Stuart.
You're very welcome. It's great to be here.
So to get started, I wonder if I can ask a question about the historical context of your article, particularly about the role of religion in politics and culture, both before and after the revolution leading up to the Napoleonic era.
Yeah, absolutely. So religion in France before the revolution is really, really central. The Catholic Church is really central to the political and social life of France pre-1789. France was almost entirely Catholic, had some very small Protestant and Jewish minorities, but the vast majority of the population was part of the Catholic Church. And the church in France had a kind of quite specific structure. So although it recognized the Pope as the head of the church, it had a number of kind of rights and liberties established as kind of the Gallican church. It also had an enormous amount of wealth, so extremely wealthy organization during the period. The revolution itself has a really, really profound impact on the Catholic Church, and in a few ways. So probably the most significant piece of early legislation emerges with the abolition of feudalism and with the nationalization of church lands. And that's kind of really crucial to the revolutionaries in trying to pay down the state's debt. But it's also followed by the civil constitution of the clergy, which is enacted in 1791, and which really divides France along religious lines. So the civil constitution of the clergy seeks to make members of the clergy civic employees of the state. So rather than being kind of employed by the church, ultimately, you know, with sort of bishops and thereby the Pope having a say over how the church is run and who is appointed to what post. The idea is that you become a salaried civil servant as a member of the clergy. And alongside this, you're expected to swear an oath to the civil constitution of the church, which is deeply divisive for members of the church who see themselves as dedicating themselves to the kind of the religious mission of the church, who see themselves first and foremost as clergymen, and feel like that would be either kind of dishonest or dividing their loyalty. So There's an excellent study of this by Timothy Tackett, but essentially it kind of divides the church in half between what are called juring or non-juring priests, either those who have been willing to swear the oath of the civil constitution of the clergy on the one hand, and the juring priests, and those who were unwilling to, the non-juring priests on the other. At the same time, you have kind of processes of de-Christianization going on, often more unofficial than official. You know, people ripping down crosses. If you go to Paris today, you can kind of see gaps in the wall where kind of religious iconography has been ripped off the walls. The biblical kings on the front of Notre Dame Cathedral are ripped off, and the statues are beheaded. Is a kind of an attack both on monarchy, but also sort of demonstrating a renewed hostility especially amongst urban populations to the church, which is kind of driven by the politics and the religious politics of the revolution. So it becomes a real kind of dividing line in France as a whole. You have in rural areas kind of the melting down of church bells. I have to remember that France from 1792 is at war with most of the rest of Europe. And so you need kind of metal for cannons. And where do the revolutionaries think they can find cannons? Well, the kind of the church bell is a really, really important source of metal, so you can kind of melt down the church bell, turn it into cannons to fight the enemies of the revolution. When we get through to the Napoleonic period, some of that sort of ardor around religion is certainly something that the Napoleonic regime is keen to sort of move beyond. Some of the most prominent revolutionaries had themselves been kind of quite deistic. Someone like Robespierre thinks religion is important. He thinks religion is a really significant way in which you can encourage people to behave in a virtuous fashion. And he kind of wants to replace what he sees as the sort of archaic and corrupt Catholic Church with a kind of a cult of the supreme being. So this kind of deistic view of a kind of a religion that's going to be based on reason, and which is going to encourage individual citizens to kind of behave in a rational and virtuous way. It's not very popular, it doesn't really take off, but gives you a sort of a sense of the way in which I suppose criticism of traditional religious practices meshes at different points with revolutionary politics. Napoleon, I think, doesn't himself have a very ardent faith. In fact, I think he sees religion primarily as a way of guaranteeing social order. So when Napoleon comes to power, one of the things he sort of tries to do is heal the religious rifts that had arisen during the revolutionary period. In 1802, he agrees a new concordat with the Catholic Church, so a new agreement to kind of reestablish Catholicism as the main religion, the established religion in France. Although, I mean, that kind of peace accord doesn't particularly last. He has a number of kind of arguments with the Pope, ends up kidnapping him and holding him hostage for a period of time, largely over kind of disputes over the kind of temporal authority of the Pope in Italy. So religion is certainly a kind of a contentious, heavily disputed area of public life during the revolution and into the Napoleonic period.
Thank you, Stuart. That context is actually really useful. My next question is sort of another context, I suppose, asking for general context and definition. In your article, you are mainly focusing on kind of new conceptions of the Druids. And I wonder if you could start by telling us who were the Druids and what was generally known about them at this point in history.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very interesting question. And I think that in many ways, the answer is very little. And actually, the Druids as kind of part of the sort of religion of the ancient Celts remain quite an enigmatic group of people to try to understand. And the main reason for that is the writings that we have about the Druids from the period when they were in existence are almost entirely from Romans or from Greek writers who were commenting on a society that they weren't members of, didn't necessarily have firsthand experience of, and in some cases were extremely hostile towards. So most of what people during the period knew about the Druids came from the commentaries of Julius Caesar in the Gallic Wars. And Caesar in the Gallic Wars is writing a text which in essence is designed to justify his conquest of ancient Gaul. It's designed to justify his policy towards the conquest of the Gallic people. So we cannot necessarily assume that the way in which he talks about the Druids in particular is either grounded in a clear-sighted understanding of how another society's religion works, or indeed entirely free from his own agenda. So Caesar talks about the Druids as, you know, practicing human sacrifice, most famously. But there's very, very little evidence to kind of support that in the archaeological record. But nonetheless, that is kind of in the 18th century that the kind of the primary source of knowledge about the Druids.
So my next question for you then is about this group that you're discussing in your article who are reconceptualizing the Druids, the Academie Celtique. Can you tell us a bit about them and what they did?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Academie Celtique, in essence, are a group of antiquarians. They're formed during the Napoleonic period. They're created by or founded by a guy called Jacques Cambry, who was the kind of the first president. And they're interesting for a number of reasons. They're interesting because they're amongst the earliest people to collect folklore. So subsequently, French folklore scholars have looked back to the Academie Celtique as the kind of the source of their academic and scholarly practice and traditions. They're also interesting because they're specifically focused on the kind of the Celtic past. So it's worth saying that there's a strong sense nowadays, I think, that in terms of thinking through the origins of the French nation, you can look back to the Gauls as the sort of the source, the original kind of foundational material of the French nation. Throughout the 19th century, you have people who really talk a lot about the kind of the Gallic origins of France, people like Amédée Thierry, who published the very, very famous Histoire des Gaulois, which kind of asserted the Gallic origins of France. You have interest in figures like Vercingetorix, who was the leader of the Gauls who fought against Julius Caesar. And kind of in contemporary society, you've got figures like in contemporary popular culture, Asterix and Obelisk, who are the kind of the cartoon versions, if you like, of these ancient Gauls who are viewed as really the proto-Frenchmen who kind of, you know, fight against Julius Caesar and the Romans in the comic books. The Academia Sinaitica are quite interesting because they emerge at this moment when the kind of the Gallic origins of France are being kind of discovered and, I suppose, repackaged as part of this national story. And so that's not necessarily a position which is very, very widespread in the 18th century, in 18th century kind of historical and antiquarian work. And it's one which they kind of self-consciously assert. They kind of said that their purpose is to rehabilitate the Gauls, to kind of to honour their ancestors, is the sort of language that they use. So the Academia Celtica are interested in kind of both in terms of the sort of history of folklore studies and kind of ethnography in France, but also this kind of production of ideas about the Gallic past and its connection to contemporary French nationalism.
So my next question is perhaps a two-part question, getting into the meat of your article, I think. What spurred the Académie Celtique's interest in the Druids? And secondly, and perhaps more importantly, how did they start to reconceptualize the Druids?
Mm. Yeah. So I think that this is a really, really interesting question. I think when you look at what the Académie Celtique are trying to do, there are a number of things that perhaps make them interested in the Druids. I think that one of the things that does clearly emerge is some figures, people like Jacques Cambry, are kind of quite committed to this kind of vision of kind of deist philosophical religion. So Cambry, founder of the Académie Celtique, sees in the Druids, I suppose, a group of people that are not dissimilar to the way in which William Stukeley in Britain is talking about the Druids. He sees them as the kind of the source of philosophical knowledge, the kind of the source of kind of wisdom and religion. And this is kind of filtered in different ways through contemporary visions of religion and its role in society. So I think the first thing to say is that there is certainly amongst some members of the Académie Celtique a degree of anti-clericalism, so a degree of hostility to Catholicism and to the Catholic Church. So the idea is almost that you have this kind of this group of sort of deist philosophers whose creed is based on applying reason to nature. That's kind of how Cambry conceptualizes the kind of the Druids in his model. And he sort of suggests that these teachings, which were originally passed on, according to him, orally by this kind of group of singers called the Bards, who would pass on kind of these moral and philosophical principles through song. And he kind of sees the influence of the Catholic Church and especially the clergy in some ways is kind of corrupting that. So he says that that's kind of one of the ways in which people are led astray through sort of superstitious sort of beliefs, not necessarily in the basis of Christianity, but in the kind of the bells and whistles, if you like, of Catholicism. So that's kind of one source. I think the other thing to say is that insofar as people think about the sort of the nature of society, religion is seen as being really, really fundamental to the morality and the mores of the kind of the people as a whole. So it's kind of something whereby the religious belief of especially kind of rural dwellers of peasants is seen as kind of absolutely central to all sorts of different aspects of their culture. And so therefore the idea of looking at the kind of religious leaders of the Gauls as being crucial to understand Gallic society in some ways kind of flows from that. And so I think that looking at the Druids and perhaps kind of trying to rehabilitate them in view of the way in which Caesar had described them in such negative terms, perhaps helps to explain how they or why they were so interested in the Druids.
You discussed looking at the Druids, or reconceptualizing the Druids rather, with an emphasis on kind of the culture of the rural peasants. Would you say that there is a class distinction or even a geographical distinction when the Academy Celtique was examining or reconceptualizing the Druids in this society?
I think there absolutely is. And I think that this actually kind of comes back to some really fundamental sort of characteristics of how late 18th and early 19th century elites conceptualized society, and conceptualized especially kind of rural dwellers and people in the kind of rural fringes of French society. So generally speaking, the work of the Académie Celtique is grounded on the idea that rural communities are, and the cultures that structure rural communities, that kind of frame the world views of the peasantries, are largely unchanging. So they have a kind of a view that the people who frame and transform society, who frame and transform kind of culture, who produce culture, are society's elites. You know, it's the educated, the intellectual who frame those kinds of things, who produce all sorts of kind of cultural kind of artifacts. And so you get this idea that because rural societies only really change insofar as they interact with urban, educated, intellectual contexts, if you are able to kind of go and travel into remoter rural areas, you can kind of get access to this kind of preserved culture. It's almost this kind of idea, well, you know, rural cultures don't change. It's like preserving beliefs and different aspects of cultural life in kind of amber. You can kind of rediscover things as they have existed unchanging for millennia. So that sort of drives, and this is not unique to the Académie Celtique, you know, this characterizes the way in which, in general, people think about rural society during this period. You know, if you think about the Grimm's collecting fairy tales in Germany, you know, that's a practice which is kind of underpinned by the idea that culture amongst rural peasantries doesn't really change. So the members of the Académie Celtique think that, well, if you can go out or get people to collect the kind of the stories, the beliefs, the traditions of people in the kind of remoter rural areas, you can have access to the stories and traditions of the past. And sort of by extension, you can recover the history of the kind of the Celtic or the Gallic people by doing that. There is no kind of written record produced by the Celtic peoples themselves from this period. So you can't, unlike with, you know, if you want to understand the ancient Romans, you can kind of go back and look at the writings of the Romans themselves. It's not possible for if you're trying to understand the Gauls. So you can kind of use the preserved traditions to access the remote past in that way.
So you were discussing how the Académie Celtique was reconceptualizing Druids, recreating these kind of modified stories of the past. And I was wondering if you can say a bit more about the role of memory and maybe even emotions in doing this.
Yeah, Absolutely. So, I mean, in terms of the kind of the public memory of, you know, the way in which sort of origin stories of the French nation emerge, members of the Académie Celtique are really interesting and important in trying to kind of establish the Celts and the Gauls as this crucial part of the kind of the French national story. And I mean, there's a few things I think going on there. There's clearly a group of people here who are kind of perhaps interested in the deist religious and philosophical projects that emerge from the Enlightenment period. It's clearly kind of influenced by that. People like Jacques Cambry definitely are. You do also have kind of a large coterie of people who come from the west of France, who come from Brittany, often kind of engaged in kind of Breton-speaking culture. So Breton is a Celtic language. It's kind of related to Welsh and to Irish. And so by constructing the kind of the Gauls, who are a Celtic people, as kind of cornerstones of the kind of the origins of the French nation, you can also integrate in that way the Breton-speaking regions of Western France into this kind of French national story, which I think is kind of quite important. You give the kind of the language and the culture of that part of the world kind of increased importance, increased status within the French kind of nation state. I think the other thing to say is that the Celts offer to a certain extent, especially as they're kind of constructed by some of the members of the Académie Celtique, a kind of an imperial prefiguring of the Napoleonic Empire. So the members of the Académie Celtique talk about Celts and Celtic and the Celtic peoples, including the Gauls, as being the kind of the original source of European civilization. So they kind of suggest that these kind of Celtic colonies settled all the way across Europe and spread kind of their sort of enlightened deistic naturalist religion to these different parts of the world, and by extension, because of the kind of the vast extent of kind of Celtic history as they conceptualize it, you can kind of say, well, you know, in some ways the Napoleonic Empire, which is uniting all of these different parts of Europe, is reconstructing this original Celtic civilization. So, I mean, in terms of sort of memory and the kind of political dimensions of history writing, there are some kind of quite obvious avenues that people kind of pursue during this period, or members of the Académie Celtique pursue during this period. In terms of the kind of emotional valence of some of this, I think probably the most interesting aspect of this kind of connects it to romantic writing, romantic travel writing, almost kind of encounters with the sublime, as it emerges through that kind of literature. So if you think of kind of someone like Chateaubriand and his kind of Memoirs from Beyond the Grave, in which he, you know, describes in great detail his kind of experiences of, you know, being on fortifications in Brittany when the kind of the storms are rolling in of the Atlantic, and sort of the feeling of insignificance in the face of the sort of the power of nature. There are parallels in terms of some of the ways in which the members of the Academy Sétique talk about their kind of encounters with the past. So one of the things they do is they are interested in the kind of the archaeological traces, as they suggest, of the Celtic peoples. So they kind of they rediscover all of these kind of dolmens and menhirs, the kind of these ancient megaliths which dot the French countryside. And they suggest, and this is actually kind of not correct, that the dating doesn't work, but they suggest that they are monuments which are or were constructed by the Celts or the Gauls for use in the kind of druidic religion. And so you have these kind of accounts of people going into the French countryside and having these kind of almost kind of encounters with a historical sublime, kind of being transported back to the earliest religious practices of the sort of ancestors of the French nation. So in that kind of sense, there's a sort of perhaps a particular way of constructing historical and archaeological practice, which is quite interesting. And certainly the way it kind of emerges on the page is quite interesting in terms of the sort of the emotional and subjective dimensions of that kind of exploration of the French interior. I suppose the last thing kind of sort of say in this regard is quite how important sort of male companionship especially is in relation to kind of some of these expeditions. They kind of seem to form you know part of the kind of male companionship of people kind of going on promenades, which is, you know, important 18th, 19th century thing to do. You know, you can kind of go on these kind of promenades through the kind of the local forest and discover these things. And part of that is about this kind of sociability, you know, between kind of the fellow antiquarians or kind of fellow intellectuals in whatever kind of town you're talking about, kind of undertaking these kind of antiquarian expeditions.
I wonder if I can probe further and ask a gender question, as you've mentioned, sort of men and their need for companionship. I mean, as you're relating druids to sort of deist philosophes as they're being reconceptualized, I guess the first part would be, were druids mainly reconceptualized as men? And secondly, kind of were women at all involved in the Academy Celtique?
Yeah, I think the answer really is no to certainly the second question. There's no real kind of involvement by women in the Academy. Looking through their letters, the only trace of a woman that I came across was in one piece of correspondence where the author apologizes for the penmanship of the letter on account of his wife rather than his usual secretary having produced the letter. So
that's in and of itself, though, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. So I think that, and in some ways, that's kind of quite surprising, because female field work in different contexts is kind of quite important. So, you know, this is also the period in which you kind of have Linnaean sort of study of the natural environment, people kind of going out and documenting different things. And I mean, Dorinda Rutram's written a little bit about that. You know, women do take part in some of that activity, and women play a really, really crucial role during this period in kind of salons, in kind of the sort of enlightened discussions that sort of take place over sort of literature and politics. You just have to think from this period of someone like Madame de Staël, who, you know, is exiled by Napoleon for writing very disobliging things about him. And so the particularly male nature of this kind of activity is quite instructive. And this is kind of, you know, entirely hypothetical, but I do wonder if that's, to a certain extent, kind of connected to maybe a project to slightly kind of try and professionalize the kind of the practice of what antiquarians are doing through this. I think that, you know, that potentially could be part of it. It could be to do also, I suppose, with the way in which antiquarianism was itself gendered.
All right, so moving away from the content of your article into some more, I suppose, personal questions, my first one for you is, what interested you in this avenue of research?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think when I was an undergraduate student, I got very, very interested in the kind of the French Revolution and in the Napoleonic period. And I think looking at kind of some of these sources, some of the ways in which the members of the Académie Celtique talk about kind of popular religion, document kind of sometimes kind of quite unusual religious practices or stories. There's just an awful lot of kind of vibrancy and diversity and interest in the kinds of materials that they talk about.
And my next question, what sources did you use in the course of this research?
So this research really was conducted, I suppose, largely on the printed publications of the Académie Celtique themselves, on the kind of the written archives, the minutes of their meetings, their correspondence, and also of kind of discussion of their activities and of their publications in the Parisian press. So you've kind of got an intersection there between kind of published material, archival material, and a little bit of reception studies. I think in some ways, some of the most sort of surprising material was, in fact, the way in which the work of the Académie Celtique was discussed by other authors, particularly in the Parisian press. And I think that really kind of underpinned some of the central findings of this particular article. And the reason for that is that the Académie Celtique is usually discussed in the context either of the sort of development of folkloric studies in France. So it's held up as a proto-folkloric organization that kind of has an influence or prefigures the study of folklore and ethnography, or it's held up as an example of kind of history as a nation-building activity, kind of history as something which is used by nationalists to kind of produce and legitimize their kind of particular political views. And I think one of the things that's really, really interesting when you go and you look at some of the kind of debates over the work of the Académie Celtique is just kind of how critical a lot of people are of them. The idea of kind of France as this kind of Celtic nation or derived from the Gauls is not actually particularly well received in many Parisian presses for a few reasons. Firstly, it's kind of associated with kind of Breton regionalism. And, you know, there are kind of people who are not particularly open to that and find this kind of Breton regionalism kind of something to be kind of mocked, I suppose, and not taken particularly seriously. I think secondly, that there is a kind of a strand of criticism which just doesn't take antiquarianism seriously, actually. And that's kind of interesting in the context of 19th century Europe, where, you know, you do have people who are kind of trying to produce these kind of national histories. This kind of particular project doesn't seem to fit very easily into any kind of sort of French conception of how nationalism and national stories should be constructed and told during the period. That's maybe to do with kind of the influence of kind of classical French culture. Maybe there's not such a feeling that you have to look back to the ancient past at this stage. And the other aspect that really, I suppose, did surprise me was the prominence of religious critiques in the work of the Académie Zétique. So there were people who, fairly prominent kind of, Catholic public intellectuals during the period, or Christian public intellectuals during the period, who really saw that the interest in kind of the pagan Celts, the pagan Gauls, and their kind of druidic priests as being kind of distasteful, and manifesting this sort of slightly sort of sinister deist philosophical approach to kind of religion and belief that they saw as dangerous, and kind of bringing them back perhaps to the religious controversies of the revolution.
And my final question, which explicitly focuses on this piece of research, is why would you say this research is valuable, or what are its broader implications?
So I think the most important implications for this research is really around how we think about the preeminence of nationalist discourse during this period of history. So I think that the principal finding, really, and the thing that I thought was really interesting, was just how marginal this group is. In many ways, certainly if you look at the sort of the publications in the Parisian press, they draw a lot of flack from these kind of intellectual circles. And so I think that's something which, in terms of how groups like the Académie Zétique have been discussed, is not always particularly clear, because we tend to be looking for these kind of forerunners of nationalist projects, the kind of the people who produce these nationalist narratives. And so that tends to be how groups like the Académie Zétique are described and discussed. It's kind of part of this sort of story of 19th century nation building, really. And so I think looking at the way in which their writing was received, the way it was kind of considered, especially in religious terms, kind of reminds us that these sorts of projects and undertakings are often very kind of complicated and can look very different to people during the period, who are kind of, have different priorities perhaps to the historian who is looking at this through the lens of our kind of much larger meta-narratives about what matters in these contexts. So I think that's the kind of the real significant contribution, is to hopefully ask people to think about setting these kinds of intellectual projects much more firmly within the kind of the critical vision of people during the period, as much as anything else.
So my final question for you then, you're finished with this research on the Académie Zétique. What's next for you? What are you working on at the moment?
So I've taken a little bit of a departure. At the moment, I'm working on a kind of comparative study of rhetorics around migration and linguistic diversity in Britain and France, largely in the 20th century. Although I'm really kind of building on the sorts of kind of questions around kind of how you draw the boundaries of the nation, how people kind of engage perhaps in nation building projects, and how that kind of intersects with different forms of cultural diversity, which I think is part of the story in this article. When you think about, well, how do these kind of regional minorities think about their kind of membership or their relationship to the French state? So there are some kind of common themes around that that kind of I think I'll continue to explore in kind of quite a different historical context.
Brilliant. And before I end the podcast, can you remind our listeners of the title of your article?
Absolutely. So the article is called Our Ancestors Were Not Celts: History, Folklore and the Celtic Past in Napoleonic France. It's published last year in the European Review of History.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Ecclesiastical History Society podcast. Stay tuned for our next podcast episode, which will be advertised on our social media pages. If you're not currently a member of EHS, we highly recommend you consider doing so. It's a great opportunity to network with other like-minded historians and keep abreast of latest research in the field. More information is on our website, ecclesiasticalhistorysociety.com.